You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, one of my favorite guests returns, Barbara Hand Clow. Barbara is an internationally acclaimed ceremonial teacher, astrologer, cosmologist, author, and Mayan calendar researcher. Her numerous books include The Pleiadian Agenda, Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, Awakening the Planetary Mind, The Mayan Code, Catastrophobia, and her recent fictional trilogy, The Revelation Series, which begins with Revelations of the Ruby Crystal and its sequel, Revelations of the Aquarian Age. Revelations of the Aquarian Age is the second of three works of fiction in the contemporary spiritual and erotic thriller genre. The quasi-fictional narratives reveal church revelations and esoteric teachings on Jesus and Mary Magdalene, holy relics, sacred sexuality, and art. Tonight, we'll be discussing the second book, Revelations of the Aquarian Age, and how it relates to past works and connects to everything in general. Barbara has taught at sacred sites throughout the world and maintains a website at www.handcloud2012.com. So let's welcome her back now. Yeah. I loved the second book and how the characters and story developed. And if the first book was largely about building a base and developing characters and the plot, then the second book was really, really took off, and it was an incredible read. What are some of the things that you've discovered about the second book since you've written it?
Well, I wrote nonfiction for about 35, 40 years, and so writing fiction was a real learning curve for me. And so in the first book, some of that shows. I think it's a good read, and I think it's a lot of fun to read it. But the second book really takes off, partly just because I, you know, learned how to play the piano, so to speak.
I've read that there were mystery schools which taught about sacred sexuality in the past. How does this come into play in the second book?
Well, it's a very important topic in the second book because the first book, the main topical material behind the characters in the story is priestly sexual abuse. And in the first book, I'm really exploring how evil comes into the world. And then in the second book, I'm dealing more with the positive aspects of sexuality because I really wanted to balance that because sexuality and sexual contact is one of the greatest sources that humans have for higher consciousness, if not the greatest source. And so some of the characters, there's a few characters who were very, very compatible and very happily married or connected. And so I'm really exploring what's going on between them because I think we don't have enough of that coverage in modern literature and in modern nonfiction.
Right, absolutely. You know, there is so much corruption in the church. Do you think that we are witnessing the end of organized religions, or could they transform into a one-world religion? You know, there was Father Malachi's prophecy, and if it's correct, and it has been to date, the present pope would be the last one.
Yeah, and I tend to feel like that's highly likely, but of course I'm not sure about that. But I do think that the Catholic Church is basically based on a pile of lies, really, a series of dogmatic decisions, mostly back in the 4th century A.D. And I think what's happening in the Church at this point is the logical outcome from some of the decisions they made 1600 years ago, have been happening very much in the last 100 years. And the priestly sexual abuse issue is very, very important because it's not just a temporary thing. It's actually a kind of a structural issue within the church itself because of celibacy and because of some of the other church dogma. And unless the church can change, and after all, Lance, we're all changing right now. We're all changing very radically now.
Right.
And if the church clings too hard to the old story and the old dogma, it's not going to hold together. I mean, for example, the issue of Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene has been scientifically verified by the research on the Talpiot tomb. And the Talpiot tomb is a tomb discovered in Jerusalem in 1980, which is the tomb of the Jesus family. And in 2015, DNA analysis was done on remnants of residue in the patina in the ossuaries in the Jesus family tomb. And they discovered that all of the people in the tomb had the same DNA except one person, and that was the ossuary. Ossuary is a bone box. And that was the ossuary that was labeled Mariamne, which is basically the tomb, the term 2,000 years ago for Mary Magdalene. It's the correct rendering of her name. And so the only person who could be buried in a family tomb in Jerusalem, the only people who can be buried there are family members or the wives and partners of family members. And then the other reason the DNA testing was done is one of the ossuaries, when the tomb was discovered in 1980, ended up being lost, and it ended up showing up on the antiquities market. And you may remember that back in the early 2000, 2003, when it went on display in Toronto. And that ossuary bore the name of James, the brother of Jesus. And so what they wanted to do was test the DNA of that ossuary as well as the 9 ones that were found in the tomb. And the DNA of that ossuary is identical with the other ones. And so James, of course, is the brother of Jesus. And so what's happening is even at the scientific level, some of these stories of Jesus and Mary Magdalene are being verified. And the church can't ignore this. You know, they can't ignore the meaning of finding the tomb of the Jesus family, for example, in Jerusalem. That's a really powerful, mind-boggling discovery.
Right, right. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you, which has to do with the age of Aquarius, because that's one of the it's kind of one of the characters in the two books so far, is that we've been hearing about the age of Aquarius for decades. I remember seeing the stage play Hair about 30 years ago in Los Angeles when they sang that song, Age of Aquarius. Do you have any idea when this age actually begins and we transition into it?
Well, when we move from one age to the other, in this case we're moving out of the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius, it's a gradual transition over about, usually around 300 years, because what happens is the influence of the new zodiac influence, it just takes time for that to come into culture. And so when Hair, for instance, was shown back in the 60s, this was one of those signs of the early awareness of the awakening of the age of Aquarius. And then what's been happening, even though media has debunked the issue as usual, what has happened is there's been a growing awareness of Aquarian consciousness, particularly technology, because Aquarius is ruled by the planet Uranus, and it's going to be a very technological age. And then the age of Pisces was the age of organized religions, which starts, Pisces started around 100 BC, and then soon after that we see the beginning of Christianity coming along with Judaism. And so what we're seeing now is the breakdown of the religions from the age of Pisces, because the age of Pisces is ending. So in my case, I'm an astrologer, and naturally I'm one of those people who's going to try to call the shift as carefully as I can. So I decided after a lot of analysis that the biggest shift out of Pisces and into Aquarius would be 2011 through 2020. And that's why this trilogy is tracking 2011 through 2020. Because when we move out of one age and go into new age, it's always very chaotic, it's always extremely stressful, extremely difficult. And what we're experiencing in our current time is a classic process that goes on with the change of the ages. And so I decided to write this trilogy partly to cast light on how that process works, because I think the more we understand how things work, the better we handle things for sure.
Hmm. I noticed that there were some fascinating connections to past lives and how they interplayed with each other. And there's a wonderful character in there who is, I think it's Lorenzo Giannini, who is a Roman Jungian analyst. And he is a fascinating character, and he uses crystals. And the work that he does with some of the lead characters is absolutely amazing. Did that just kind of write itself? Is it your pen hit the paper?
Well, that's a great question, Lance, because the way this trilogy occurred was in 2011, I had basically really finished my major works like Mayan Code and Pleiadian Agenda and Alchemy of Nine Dimensions. I kind of come to a point where I had a body of work that I needed to write and publish, and I was done. And then what was I going to do, you know? And so I put it out there that I wanted to write fiction because I wanted to have greater artistic license and I wanted to have a greater creative zone that I could work with. And so I just put that out there. And then the Pleiadians, by the way, these are beings from the Pleiades star system, they tend to talk to me. And when they talk to me, they always tell me to get out a yellow pad and a pen and write things down. So one day they said, get out your pad and write it down. And I wrote 4 pages furiously over a period of an hour or two, with the names of the characters, the ages, the background, the psychology, the intellectual interests that they had, and the relationships they had with each other. And I was just amazed by it. As you know from reading Ruby Crystal, it's 2 generations with parents, and then younger, and then children, basically in their 20s through their 40s. And so then I had it. I had the characters. But back to Lorenzo Giannini, he wasn't on the list. And so then what happened is when I was 2/3 of the way through Ruby Crystal, I hit a wall basically with Armando Pierleone. And
yeah,
Armando Pierleone is a very complex, wonderful artist who has a very, very complex emotional and sexual reality. And I just hit a wall, and I went, now what I do? And I was sitting there, and Lorenzo Giannini appeared in my office. And it was the most amazing experience. I've only had beings like that appear just a couple of times in my life. And it wasn't like you standing there. It was just like a being.
Huh.
And he said, well, in case you're interested, I've been dealing with Armando for 10 years now. He's been in analysis with me.
So I got out
my yellow pad and wrote down all the information about Lorenzo Giannini, and that's where he came from.
Oh my God.
I know.
Amazing.
That was really an amazing moment. And so then in the second book, what has happened, as you know, because you read it,
right,
is he ends up gradually, one by one, doing psychotherapy with the characters in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And this is continuing in book 3. And gets even more complex. Because eventually, of course, the character, I'm writing it right now, so I know what's going on. And of course, eventually the characters start to compare notes on what's going on in, when they have their analysis. And meanwhile, what Lorenzo is doing is he's doing a lot of past life therapy. And also, light hypnosis and stuff like that. And in my case, I've done 100 sessions into my past lives under hypnosis, and I wrote a trilogy about that called the Mind Chronicles trilogy.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, remember
I
that?
Have it.
And so fortunately, regarding Lorenzo, I'm able to work on past life regression and between lifetimes because I've had so much experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just having a blast with it because it adds a whole extra dimension to works of fiction to have layers like this.
Oh, yes, yes. And also it's probably quite accurate, even if it's a fictional instance that you're writing about, it probably is quite true that is definitely how things can be working out.
Yeah, yeah. And then having done it myself, you don't have to say, to insist that these are past lives, or
right.
You don't have to believe
right.
that. You
right.
know, But you can, for a person in light trance, light hypnosis, can travel in the past and can get into the mind of people who have lived in the past.
Yes.
And so some of the people who come up, of course, are fascinating. Because these are first of all, the characters in this trilogy are really interesting people. And so naturally they have interesting past lives. And that has turned out to be true. Therapists have definitely noticed that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. I know that the central focus of the Aquarian Age is a painting of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and a bee, which is actually one of the most important aspects of his painting. And Armando is subconsciously painting something that is quite profound and shows Jesus walking between two worlds, basically. And the desire for Mary Magdalene and their love for each other. And of course, the theories are that they actually did marry and had children, and those children are alive today, you know, the offshoots of those children. And Armando is able to display these paintings in one of the famous cathedrals because they know the Medicis. Now, were you aware of the Medicis? Do you have any connection to them, or did you just...
I don't know where that one's going. It's going someplace in the third book, but I can't tell yet. Like Alessandro de' Medici is a character in the third book, and I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know any of the Medicis personally.
Uh-huh.
But I've spent a lot of time in Italy, and a lot of the characters in this book are coming from kind of, I would say, kind of a combination of Italian people that I've known in this lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't do anything like to research the Medicis particularly. I'm just letting a few of them be characters. But here's an interesting thing that has occurred with that. One of the things that happens when you're working with this kind of art form is stuff will come through you, and then later on you find out that something was happening in the outside world at the same time. And have you seen Salvatore Mundi by Leonardo da Vinci? Have you seen that yet? Did you see it? The painting of Christ? This is the one that was authenticated about 6 months ago as being by Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah. And it came through. It's a painting of Christ, and I've seen pictures of it. I haven't been able to see it. And it's called Salvatore Mundi, which means the Savior of the World. And it is just incredible. It is, you know, they use the term real presence, something that actually brings the sense of Christ through art. And that painting was authenticated and came through to the public exactly when the painting came through in Revelations of the Aquarian Age. And in both cases, these are breakthroughs from some kind of dimension connected to the issue of Christ. And you have to ask, well, why am I working with Jesus? Why am I working with Christ? Well, I'm doing it because I'm just inspired to do it. But also, what I'm beginning to see in the trilogy is that as we come to the end of the Age of Pisces, what's happening is I think we're getting the resolution of the Jesus issue and the Christ issue. Because something happened 2,000 years ago that affected the whole planet. This is a being who is revered by Muslims, by Islamic people, by Jews, by Christians. Everybody on the planet has a great deal of reverence for this person. And I think what's happening is I think we're getting the resolution for that now, which is, at least to me, is very exciting.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I had never been aware of were the works of Gaudi and La Sagrada Familia.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaudi's flying buttresses, and he was way ahead of his time. How does he figure into the storyline? as a character.
Yeah, well, a character named David Appel, who's a Jewish businessman from New York City, who ends up, his son ends up in Italy, and then his daughter ends up in Italy, and so he's very involved with Italy. And so when he's in Rome, he was feeling a lot of disturbance. You know, in fact, I'm using these characters also to show the kind of disturbance that we're all feeling right now. Because as we go through this transition into Aquarius, a lot of us are really having a great deal of disturbance. And so David becomes disturbed and can't figure out what's going on. And so he's one of the first characters to go to Lorenzo Giannini.
Yes.
And then Lorenzo regresses him, and lo and behold, it turns out his past life was Antonio Gaudí.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, from Barcelona, yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating process, and the geometry that occurs around these past life recalls is really quite breathtaking.
Yeah, and all I can say about that is I work with crystals a lot myself, and so while I'm working and writing, I'm also working with crystals a lot. And what happens for me when I'm actually working is the things that you're seeing in the book, the geometrical things that are coming through, are actually happening for me visually. And they're really hard to describe.
Yeah.
And basically, as you read it, I don't think the reader probably can really, or maybe the reader sees it. I don't know. It could be some kind of primal vein of consciousness that you can see if you read about it. I'm not sure. But people are telling me that they're really taking off on trips just by reading it.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. No question about it. It was almost like it almost stimulated kind of an out-of-body experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they definitely have significance in these, with the geometric forms that you describe, mm-hmm. which no doubt is connected to the crystals, which you're using to assist with the seeing of the images that you're writing down.
Yeah, and it's in that case, it's because that's what's actually happening with the characters. The interesting thing about fiction is that if it isn't actually happening for me as a writer, it's not going to happen on the page. And you know what I mean. And so my own personal experience with this was that when I channeled the Pleiadian agenda back in 1994-95, that whole process started with me seeing an icosahedral crystal in front of my face for about 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat there and contemplated it. And what happened was a download came from that crystal into my consciousness. So for me, that's the only time I've ever experienced that. But what it's done is it's created a whole body of work. Because the Pleiadian agenda came in, and then Alchemy of Nine Dimensions came in as research on the Pleiadian agenda. And all of that is coming from that transmission from an icosahedron, which is a platonic solid with 20 faces and 12 points on it. Really fascinating, complex platonic solid.
Right, right. One of the lines I was just looking at, which I appreciate, is as we move into Aquarius, we are to recover our multidimensional intelligence. And in your work, The Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, which for me was kind of a pinnacle of how to envision the way we are created to actually access nine dimensions simultaneously, it's so simple and it's so beautiful, and it gave me a tool that I could use to actually tap into other dimensions at once. And even though there's a lot of interference between the actual dimensions and here, interference waves, it can be done. And that book really empowered me quite a bit. So it seems that we will be able to recover our multidimensional intelligence. And how do you see that unfolding for people? Perhaps a loss of duality and the black and white either or thinking
Well, the way I'm seeing it is I've been out teaching this material now for 23 years because as soon as Pleiadian agenda came in, then I started teaching it and kept on going with alchemy. And so when I first started teaching it, back in 1994, 95, basically, people had no idea what I was talking about. And to tell you the truth, I really didn't either. I mean, it channeled through me, and it came, and then I tape recorded the channelings, and then I made a book out of the material, but I didn't understand very much of it. And so over this period of 23 years, I teach with my husband Jerry, and what we're seeing is we're seeing that students have the ability to understand this material much more easily as time has gone by. We used to teach 2.5-day workshops in order to help people understand this material, and now we're able to convey it in a 1-hour workshop, and people are actually able to get it. Mm-hmm. So then, seeing that happen, also, things have gone on since alchemy. In other words, alchemy is an analysis of the Pleiadian agenda and all the ways in which science is discovering the same material, as you know from having read it. Mm-hmm. But, of course, alchemy, the final version of alchemy came out in 2010. But the discoveries regarding this material continued. And the first one that was really important was the discovery of the Higgs boson at the end of 2012 in the particle accelerator at CERN, because the discovery of the Higgs boson confirmed the validity of superstring theory. And the Pleiadian agenda and alchemy of nine dimensions is basically the same as superstring theory. So the verification of scientifically of superstring theory is a really big deal regarding this body of work. Mm-hmm. And then, Lance, the latest thing that's happened will just blow your mind. I haven't yet found anybody who's heard of this, but you might have. Have you heard of the Blue Brain Project in Switzerland? Does that ring any kind of a bell? Are you there?
I kind of lost. I'm still trying to hear you through the...
Yeah, I know you're having trouble. I'm talking as like,
yeah.
Okay. Have you ever, what I'm referring to is the Blue Brain Project.
Oh, and, I don't know that.
Okay. Well, with the Blue Brain Project, which is a group of Swiss scientists who are working with algebraic topology, and we don't need to explain what algebraic topology is, but basically these scientists have uncovered the architecture of the human brain. And they have been able to show on computers with algebraic topology that our brain processes reality in 11 dimensions.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so at this point, we have the proof of superstring theory.
Yeah.
And then we have the proof that our brains process according to the 11 dimensions of superstring theory. Now, the reason this is such a big deal for me personally, it's actually going to be quite a burden and from one point of view, is that Alchemy of Nine Dimensions is the only book I've ever seen that explains how we humans get in touch with those levels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In other words, like, what's the difference between one dimension and another, and how do we pick up that information?
Yes.
So my switch to fiction has, I literally did not understand until about 2 weeks ago why I switched to fiction. I've been doing this stuff totally on faith. And what I've realized is that when you read these, when you read, one of the books in the trilogy, what's happening is you are actually encountering 11 dimensions in the book.
Uh-huh.
And what it's doing is it's teaching people through watching these characters how to pick up on these levels. And
yes.
I just had a class 2 nights ago with a group of really wonderful students. And what one of the things we were talking about is that this is happening really fast at this point.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
People are really having a hard time. The faster it goes, the harder it is. And anything we can get a hold of at this point, you know, that gives us a sense of, like, how this works and how we need to work with this issue is really going to be pretty critically important, as far as I can see.
But it seems that the nature of thought is changing because as things speed up, words will be less necessary, and we will be probably switching to images, symbols, light languages, and so on, that will be so fast that we'll understand huge blocks of information with just an image.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's very, very true. And it's getting through this passage, you know, getting through this gateway right now that's so difficult.
It's kind of like the chess game that Spock on Star Trek used to play on many levels. And if you envision that as multidimensional thinking, then you can actually do it, but you can't say that, well, this I believe and this I don't believe. It's a process of accepting that everything has truth on the level from which it originates. And so if you see something you don't agree with, then you have to find the level at which it originates, and then there's truth in it. And so then it's more like a game or a puzzle or a mystery. And once you solve the level that you're looking at, there are no contradictions.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that's what's so confusing. And the really funny thing about it is the person who embodies this from one point of view, probably just because he's in the position that he's in, is Donald Trump.
Oh, really?
Well, you know what I mean. He just goes this way, just goes that way. He doesn't care what he said the day before. He doesn't care what he said the minute before.
I like that, to be honest with you. He's the first person who's ever, and he's the first person who's ever tweeted, and he's willing to speak his mind. Every president up until that time has been so secretive and so guarded and so scripted that, you know, we just know that they're probably reading some from a teleprompter, something that somebody else has told them to say.
The big difference here is they're controlled. And so what we're experiencing one by one as individuals is all the control that ran everything is disappearing. And we're still used to that. We're still used to being controlled. I mean, that's why this part of it is so hard.
Yes, yes. Now, there was something that you brought up in the book, and it had to do with the Templar, William F. Mann, and he apparently has a book or two out, and it covers the real story of America, and it has to do with the Templars and the lineage here in America. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this guy's amazing. He's a Canadian, actually he's the head of the Templar Order in Canada. And he's a great researcher. And, he has written a couple of books about, the bloodline, coming to, this is around, the 14th century, the 1300s. And, the Templars, coming across to America and bringing, the descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And then what happened is once they got over here, and I think some of the Templars were also descendants, and then once they got over here, they intermarried with the Algonquin and different tribal people in America. And this guy's name is William Mann, and he's written a couple of books about the Templars. People can just check out the name and then go for the books. And that brings up another issue, Lance, which is these books are truly fiction, my books, this trilogy, in the sense that these are real characters living real experiences. But the background material in the book is all exactly accurate and factual. And so when one of my characters is heavily influenced by an idea or by a writer, then what will happen is the character will tell a friend, oh, I read this book by William Mann, and this is what was going on with this book. So I don't want to present somebody's material without giving them credit. But I think a lot of people, after reading these books, are probably going to go out and read 10 or more books just based on my book.
I see he has one out called The 13th Pillar.
Yeah.
And that one sounds really interesting, too.
And that's a novel.
Right. That's not factual.
Yeah, it is factual, but it's a novel. Like my novels,
right.
Yeah, like for instance, Dan Brown and I are factual, but we're writing novels.
Right.
And that's what initially when I switched to fiction, a lot of my fans were pretty upset because they thought.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, they thought that I would quit doing what I've been doing for, you know, my first book came out in 1976 and they were going, oh no, she's gone. But, what's happening is that fiction is allowing me to, it's almost like, you know those kaleidoscopes that are so much fun to look through
uh-huh.
where you see all, you know, those patterns?
Yeah.
Fiction is enabling me to take an issue to a much, much more complex level.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're having so much more fun weaving ideas and things in together that are truths woven into a fictional tapestry, and it's quite lovely. And your descriptions of the Roman, the buildings and the architecture and the beautiful interiors of these places is just breathtaking. And, you know, frankly, for those of us who aren't going to get to Rome and who don't know rich people over there, it's really the only chance we'll get to just savor and just soak in all that beautiful culture that has been going on there for thousands of years.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I managed just by happenstance and luck to meet some really interesting people over there, and I can't go into it because I can't reveal any of that. But
right.
It is true that there's a window into the elite, and another thing I'd have to say is that there's a tendency to think that elite people are all bad. That they're powerful, you know, and they're manipulative, and some of them are, of course. But there's also a lot of really, really fine elite people on this planet who are really attempting to really help this planet. And so that's another thing I wanted to do is I wanted to describe people who live at that level but are really, really good people, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and then the illustrations, that's my daughter.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They are just stunning.
I know, isn't it wonderful? Yeah.
She did a fabulous job on those illustrations. They are just beautiful.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, they couldn't be
better.
Really
fun to work with her.
You were so fortunate to have a talented daughter like that to do the. And then when I come across one, it's like I just stop and I look at it and take it in.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One question that I'll bring up briefly is, what's the significance of the Black Madonna?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. As you know, she showed up, in this case, she's on, Mallorca, which is, you know, I think part of Portugal. And, of course, what she does is she shows things about how the characters are thinking
uh-huh.
and feeling, particularly Jennifer. But I have a feeling that's going to come up in the third book. It hasn't yet. But I have a feeling there's a lot of meaning behind that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to be in the middle of a process like this because I really actually don't know what's going to happen.
Well, that's
and these
good.
And then these characters, I love my characters. And
I do too.
I know, and I'm meeting people out there who love my characters. And so in my case, when I write, I get a chance to be with my characters because otherwise, you know, I'm just out in my regular everyday life.
Uh-huh.
And I like hanging out with them because they're fun.
Oh, they are. They are just, Claudia is mm-hmm. just such a sophisticated and talented and psychic hoot. She's
yeah.
just, I love, I mean, all the characters are delightful in this book.
Oh,
and the transformations they go through as well. It's really, you get to love the characters, and I think that people who haven't read the first book would probably enjoy starting there.
Yeah,
because
I think so.
You really have to be with the characters as they develop to understand where they're coming from. I really do think it's necessary to start at the beginning of the trilogy.
Yeah, and as you know, each book in a trilogy has to be a standalone. So when you pick up Revelations of the Aquarian Age, it's a standalone. It just starts with the first chapter with everybody showing up at a wedding and off it goes. But I completely agree with you. I think that it would be better for people to start with Ruby Crystal. to get the full richness.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You're working on the third book, right? Is the Aquarian Age out in the public now?
Yeah, the Aquarian Age was released in the middle of February 2018. So it just came out.
Wonderful. So it is available for sale.
Yes, it's good. On Amazon or bookstores.
Wonderful.
Or yeah.
Because I know I got a review copy, thank goodness, so I was able to read it without having to worry about it being out there. But how are you doing on the third book? And since it covers the period going to 2020, it's going to be interesting to see what your various channels and senses and intuition tell you about what will happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
I can't wait to see.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a feeling that there will be some kind of grand resolution. Until we actually have it in our hands, we won't know.
And of course, I don't know. Okay.
Right.
Right now, the third book is tracking 2018 through 2020, as you said, the end of 2020.
Oh yes.
Yeah. And can you imagine trying to describe reality 2018 to 2020?
Oh my God.
I know. And so the I would say the greatest gift of this trilogy is the selection of detail.
Yes.
Because so much is going on that what I've had to do is I've had to pick the events in reality that really reflect the shift from the age of Pisces into Aquarius.
Right.
So it's a selection of detail. And, you know, I'll give you one hint. Donald Trump. One of the things that I've done in the trilogy is I've gone back to the previous shifts of the ages. Like, for example, we came out of the age of Aries around 100 BC, and we went into Pisces. And so one of the characters is a researcher on that particular period of time, and we get a chance to see what happened during the previous shift. And one of the big key players in the previous shift was St. Paul of Tarsus. And what Paul did, he was a Jew, of course, and he came along and became a Christian. And he just basically went, just throw this out, dump that, get rid of circumcision, dump the old, all the stuff about how you're supposed to eat your food, and do it this way. And Trump reminds me of St. Paul. Because he's just coming in and just throwing things out and creating something new.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know? So I don't know how, I'm not trying to say that I think his past life is St. Paul. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that he seems to be playing that role of the person who dumps at the end of an age.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, also, isn't there a paradigm shift where the old paradigms begin to collapse because they can no longer function in a higher energy field, and the new paradigms begin to emerge that have been built, have been building all along to transcend or transform the old?
Yeah, so it's a combination of stuff just ending. There will be a certain amount of stuff just ending, and that's obviously happening. But there's also a tremendous tendency for structures that exist to transform into something else. And so we may see Christianity, for example, transform into something else, maybe something like that. So it's a combination of stuff just ending, transformations, and then the new energy coming in. And what has to happen is there has to be enough space for the new energy. If things don't change and if things don't transform, there's no space for changes coming in.
Mm-hmm. So you're working on book three now. Do you have a guesstimate as to the time frame that it will take to put that one out?
It can't come out before 2021 because I have to go through 2020. But
right.
One thing that I do think is going to be an influence here is that Jupiter conjunct Saturn every 20 years. And it's called a trigon. And when Jupiter conjuncts Saturn, an old pattern stops and a new one comes in, because Jupiter rules fortune and well-being and Saturn rules structure. So the last trigon, the last conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, was in 2000 when George Bush got in. And George Bush just took that energy of that new Jupiter-Saturn cycle and invaded Iraq and created all the stuff. And it's still going on at this point ad nauseum. It seems like it'll never end, you know, that stuff
yes.
that George Bush started.
Right.
But the next trigon, yeah, the next Saturn conjunct Jupiter is May of 2020. And the reason why I think this is the Aquarian age is because Jupiter conjunct Saturn in May 2020 in 0 degrees Aquarius.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when I saw that, I went, okay, there we go.
That's it.
Yeah,
bingo.
We will really have come to some kind of resolution or maybe big explosion. I don't know what exactly.
I don't care at this point.
Yeah, it's so chaotic that we don't care.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
Well, one of the things that you brought up in the book, and I was curious to find out if you've been exposed to them yourself or if you have one, were those fascinating 13 crystal skulls.
Mm-hmm. That's you know, one of the characters, David Appel, actually has one of the 13 crystal skulls, the original ones. I certainly don't have one, that's for sure. But my character can have one.
Oh, sure.
And he does. And, you know, David Appel is an absolutely fascinating person. And, he's really gonna go, these older characters, mature characters, are really gonna go to amazing levels in book
three. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It kind of boggles the mind because it's all new territory and it's really laying out something that is of some place where we're headed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not everyone is headed there, but certainly in general, this is a direction that we all seem to be headed, is our own evolution.
Yeah, that's true, Lance. And then also I'd like to say that I'm one of those people who believes that before about 500 BC, about 2,500 years ago, I think that people on the planet had nine-dimensional consciousness. I think this is something that we lost and that we're recovering. And I really believe that. And as a teacher, I can see in people that what they're doing is they're recovering something that they've lost. And when it comes back to them, they remember it. And so I think it's going to be, from that point of view, a little bit easier than we think, because we're recovering something that we've lost. And certainly the third book is, a lot of the theme of the third book is the basic themes are the recovery of ancient perennial wisdom. You know, and so I need those characters like David Appel and Pietro Pierleone, because I need those mature, you know, magus type people basically in order to show that.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I had a lot of fun reading this book, and I went ahead and I used a highlighting pen, which I didn't want to do, but I also wrote notes in the ledge, you know, in the sides and on the top, because I didn't want to miss anything. And, so I did kind of wreck the book up.
I do the same thing.
But, you know, now I know where everything is and also where I want to go back and research, because you've left a trail of breadcrumbs that will open doors into worlds that I am unaware of. And so you may not have described in enough detail what some of these people have done, but it's our responsibility to go back and do the research and find out for ourselves, you know, who they are and what is it that they discovered, and, you know, the Algonquins and all that. Those are things I just had never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's so much that we don't know and so much that's kept from us. So
yeah.
that which we can find out about, it seems like we have an obligation to kind of dig and research and find out what we can.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. Like the Algonquin rituals were written down, I think, about 100 years ago. Because they had really unusual, detailed rituals in their culture. And I have a book of the Algonquin rituals, and they're basically the same as the Templar and the Masons. And so, of course, William Mann thinks that when the Templars came over, they initiated the Algonquins and gave them the rituals. And of course, the Algonquin have all kinds of other rituals. Like in my case, I'm part Cherokee. And there's a whole range of rituals and teachings. You know, all of the indigenous cultures are just rich with all these different data banks. And so this is not saying that the Algonquins don't have all of the, you know, the rituals, Native American indigenous rituals that we recognize and respect. But they also have this body of teachings that's basically the same as the Masons and the Templars. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And this comes out in William Mann's work. This is not my research. I'm covering him because I think he's so important.
Wow. Well,
and I'm still acting like a publisher, Lance. Because as you know, I was the acquisitions editor for Barron Company.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's the best publishing company on the planet, really.
And what happened with being a publisher, one of the reasons I wrote so many books was as an acquisitions editor, and this is typical of a publisher, I wanted to publish certain materials, and I was looking for them, and I was hunting everywhere for somebody who had written books on that particular subject. And so what would happen is I finally get to the point where I could see that nobody else is going to do it, so then I would do it.
Uh-oh.
You know? And so now I'm writing novels that'll get people to read, because what could be more important than reading good books?
Oh, yeah.
Especially at a time in history like this. I mean, for all of the younger people who are listening, and you're just using your handheld devices all the time, books are really important, you know?
And the art of storytelling is really, it goes back to the clans and the small groups that were traveling around the planet so many thousands of years ago. Storytelling was an art, and I think it is possible with a renaissance that it will be elevated once again to high art, and especially if people like you that know enough to make it a good art are coming out with books that everybody would like to read. And I can highly recommend this one because it is really worked on so many different levels, and the most important one, of course, being our entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that was another reason I wanted to write fiction, was I wanted to entertain.
Yes. I love your other books and get excited about the discoveries in them, these books are really, they're just as deep, if not deeper, and they have an entertaining set of characters and interactions. I mean, it's really a wonderful read.
Well, thanks, Lance. And I'd like to put another data bank in there that I think is important.
Okay.
That's behind this trilogy, which is before 500 BC, whenever an age would change, and that would be like 2000 BC, 4000 BC, 6000, you know, whenever an age would change, teachers would help people understand how to let go of the old age and how to bring in the new one. And so this ceased for the last 2,500 years. We haven't basically had that teaching in our culture. And so these books are teaching books about how to deal with the change of the ages.
Yes, yes. Well, Barbara, you know, we've run out of time. And I just want to thank you for coming back and sharing your thoughts and so on about the books. And you're welcome back anytime if you want to talk again about these subjects or others. And I just can't thank you enough for doing what you're doing out there.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you, as you know. It's my pleasure.
All right. Good night, Barbara, and good night, everybody.
Good night, Lance.